Kia ora and welcome to the South Pacific Weather Training Teleclass Lecture. My name is Jill Gergen and I'm speaking to you from the Australian Infection Control Association biennial conference, which is being held in the lovely city of Melbourne, Australia. Unfortunately, neither Paul Webber, who established the Webber Training Program, nor Jane Barnett, the facilitator of the South Pacific Series, could make it here today. So as a Kiwi user of the Webber Training Series, I've been given the task of introducing today's lecture. I think it's rather interesting we've got a Kiwi introducing a Canadian to an Australian audience. I realise that the telecast education concept is fairly new to many of in the audience, so I'll give you a brief outline of how it works. It's a telephone-based education system that as long as you have access to a speakerphone and the lecture slides, either via a data projector if there are a number of you listening, or via a handout, you can access internationally renowned speakers for the cost of the phone call and a small registration charge. That cost covers any number of people in the room who can listen in to the lecturer, and because of time zone differences, every lecture is broadcast live and again later at a later time. They are also then made available as a recording on the website. As infection control practitioners, this enables us to bring speakers to lecture rooms in our organisations who otherwise we would not have access to unless funded to attend conferences, not unlike this one. Education is at the forefront of everything we do in infection control, so this is a fabulous way of us facilitating this for ourselves and those in our organisations. So in summary, this live broadcast is being listened to by the 530 delegates here in Melbourne, potentially hundreds more in Australasia, and thousands more on the rebroadcast in the Northern Hemisphere. It's a truly international event. Any coughs and sneezes from the audience will therefore also be heard worldwide. Without further ado, I would like to welcome today our speaker today, Dr. Dick Zoutman, who is one of the keynote speakers of this conference. Dr. Zoutman is Chief of the Department of Medical Microbiology and Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control at the Southeastern Ontario Health Sciences Centre in Kingston. He is also Professor of Pathology and Molecular Medicine, of Community Health and Epidemiology, and of Medicine at Queen's University. A primary focus of his investigative work has been understanding the prevention and control of healthcare-associated infections and related medical errors. He is Physician Director of the Board of the Community and Hospital Infection Control Association of Canada, otherwise known as CHICA. And during the 2003 outbreak of SARS in Toronto, Dr. Zoutman chaired the Ontario SARS Scientific Advisory Committee responsible for advising the Ontario government on management strategies of the SARS outbreak. As of 2004, Dr. Zoutman was appointed co-chair of the Ontario Provincial Infectious Diseases Advisory Committee. The subject for today's teleclass is very appropriately Ontario in the post-SARS era, rebirth of the public health and infection control. Welcome to Australia, Dick, and thank you for agreeing to be the first Webber Training Lecturer at ACA.
Well, good morning, and thank you very, very much to ACA and to the sponsors and the organizers and to all of you for the wonderful invitation to be here in Australia. This is my first visit, and my wife Heather accompanied me, and we're very grateful for the warm hospitality and everything that you've given us to be here today. I do commend to you the Webber training classes, the teleclasses. Paul Webber is a friend and colleague, and he lives in Belleville, Ontario, about 100 kilometers just to the west of where I live in Kingston, Ontario, and we both live between Toronto and Ottawa, if you want to get oriented where we're coming from. And the Webber teleclass training series is truly becoming international, and its accessibility, which is wonderful and makes it very valuable to you. I want to talk to you about, in a very personal way, what the impact was of the SARS outbreak from one person's perspective, and this is how it looked to me. So it's not a scientific presentation, but more a reminiscence and looking back over the last 5 years what happened in Ontario. Hearing the amazing successes and innovations here in Australia and really throughout the world in my travels, it's clear that infection control has moved to a higher plane. And I started off in infection control when I felt like nobody really cared. And now people care deeply, and we have commissions and national advisory bodies and so forth. So I do encourage you to continue to play a leadership role because you are being successful in this regard. Ontario is the biggest province geographically in Canada. It is in central Canada. Kingston, Ontario is just on the north shore of Lake Ontario here, a very scenic location, and one of Canada's oldest cities. It was previously the capital of Canada, but Queen Victoria, in her wisdom, thought the Yanks were going to come and invade us, so she moved the capital up to Ottawa. Toronto is here, a little bit westward, and Ottawa is northeast of us. And I did a little comparison of Australia versus Canada just to get myself oriented. We're both vast countries. Ontario itself as a province is 1 million square kilometers, Canada almost 10 million square kilometers, and Australia 7.7 million square kilometers. The amount of water is quite different. In Canada, we're a water-wealthy country at about 9% and 14, almost 15% in Ontario. In Australia, it's a little different, 1%. So water is a real important resource. Our population bases are different. Ontario, around 12 million people. Canada, around 34 million. Australia, 21 million approximately. Our population densities are quite similar between Canada and Australia. We have vast swaths of land where you wouldn't be able to see anybody for quite some time. Ontario is largely populated along the southern portions of the province. Our gross domestic product expressed here in U.S. dollars is likewise proportionally similar, and the per capita income is very similar as well. We're both wealthy countries by any standard. A comparison of our healthcare systems, life expectancy in Australia is a wee bit longer, so congratulations. Infant mortality is a bit lower. Your physician ratio is a little bit more generous. Your nursing ratio seems to be a little bit higher. Your number of beds seems to be substantially higher, and I'm not so sure if that's just a quirk of the data that I pulled off or not. We'll talk about that later. Your dollars spent per capita on health care are quite similar, a little bit less than what Canada spends, and as a percent of GDP, 9.1% versus our 9.4, fairly similar, and the Human Development Index almost identical. So we have a lot of things in common besides our quirky use of the English language. And Ontario is a beautiful province. It has wonderful geography and variable geography. And we live on Lake Ontario with my wife Heather, kayaking in Lake Superior, actually. And this is the capital of Ontario, which is Toronto, and the famous CN Tower. And all of that was brought to a halt by an outbreak in 2003 of a very unusual coronavirus that crippled much of the infrastructure in Ontario, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what has gone on since that time. But as I look back to March 2003, this was the province of Ontario's first ever formally declared provincial emergency. We had an unknown etiologic agent of an acute respiratory illness that we thought was infectious, but we didn't know that right off, that it was spreading rapidly in the hospital sector in particular. We know that, and we're aware of the information from Hong Kong, where the virus was also being understood and causing even a substantially larger outbreak, and the links to the famous Metropole Hotel. As it turns out, that was the direct link for the virus into Canada, where a visitor at that hotel comes back to Canada on February 23rd, returning from Hong Kong, and dies at home of an unknown respiratory illness, nursed by her two sons, who come into the emergency department, succumb themselves, and the outbreak takes off in the hospital sector. It was declared a provincial emergency because of the scope of the outbreak. It was clear that in Ontario this was a concern that it could spread across the entire province. We weren't certain where all the cases were, and the desire was to get ahead of this before it got ahead of us, and in hindsight, this was, I think, a good decision. The initial challenge then, of course, was no name for this thing, no clear-cut clinical diagnosis, no laboratory tests, no idea entirely of the clinical course, what the long-term implications. We weren't clear how it was spread. We initially felt it was airborne and realized later it was more like a droplet. When does the infection start? When does it finish? Is there immunity issues? And so forth. Well, all of the things that had to be discovered in rapid pace. The ultimate infection control challenge. The ingenuity that came to bear in dealing with this was really remarkable around the world. I will show you a few Ontario examples. This is North York General Hospital, their ambulance bay, which was converted into an assessment clinic. They hung drapery, they changed the ventilation. The drapery was coated in thick layers of plastic where they had assessment centers, and they were using the infection control precautions of the day, which was contact precautions with an N95 respirator and facial protection. It took us a while to realize that SARS was a hospital event. The majority of the cases that occurred in Ontario were in the hospitals for us. And household transmission, while it did occur, was significantly less, but it did require close contact, and that it wasn't acting like an airborne virus, thank goodness. We did have a few community events that worried us. A particular community had a death in their religious community, and there was a big funeral I think it was late March, and we were concerned what that may have to do in terms of transmission. We did see some transmission in that regard. But as you can see, even in the two waves of SARS that we endured, we realized this was a hospital event, not exclusively so, also seeing transmission in paramedic units, for example, ambulances as well. I got a phone call from my friend and colleague, Dr. Don Lowe, in Toronto, and Don said, there's a problem in Toronto. You've heard about this virus. We've got some cases. Could you come down in a few days and lend us a hand? I said, sure. And 3 months later, I was still there. And we developed the Ontario SARS Scientific Advisory Committee. And necessity was the mother of the invention. And this committee sort of spontaneously erupted to help manage the SARS outbreak. And we had to make a myriad number of decisions. And we had Ministry of Health folks who were policy experts and could tell us when we were coming up with ideas that were frankly illegal. So they kept us honest. And Alison Stewart, who is now the director of the Emerging Measures Unit, now an acting assistant deputy minister, was instrumental as our lead person to allow this committee to form. We put out a call for individuals to help us from all over Canada to join this committee because many people who you'd like to have there were busy doing something else, controlling things at home. So it wasn't easy to get people into the committee, but there were many people who managed to help us out under really difficult and arduous circumstances. We had infection control practitioners, public health experts. We worked through the Provincial Operations Center, people from the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, our hospitals branch, the public health branch, and emergency medical services. We had in people from community practice settings, family physicians, and nursing and occupational health, all participating. One of the challenges was that the membership kept changing as people had to go back to their hospitals as issues evolved for them. So we had quite a wide range. We even had a Provincial Operating Center POC scientist, a nuclear physicist, who was an expert in things to do with the nuclear energy if there was ever a problem in that regard. But his knowledge of protocols in disasters was second to none, so he was very helpful. So we developed a structure relating to the Minister of Health of the day, Mr. Tony Clement, who's now our federal Minister of Health. Mr. Hassan was our deputy minister, is now the president of the Canadian Patient Safety Institute, and Alison Stewart was our executive lead, and Jim Young was the commissioner then of the public safety and security, to which the SARS Scientific Advisory Committee reported. And we also worked directly with the Commissioner of Public Health of the day, Dr. Colin DiCunha, and the 37 health units. So we had a structure that allowed us to develop directives. And those directives were best policy based on the evidence we could get from around the world, were developed in rapid pace. And one of the first measures was to go to what we call in Ontario a code orange. And that is where we would shut the hospital systems down, effectively for emergency services only. So people with trauma, people having babies and things could be served, but elective procedures and such were effectively closed down. And I remember typing that one on a laptop in the government boardroom we were using in the wee hours of the night and handing it over to Alice and saying, I hope I got it right. We put out the directives in a somewhat helter-skelter fashion, and we developed a rhythm to people were getting them, and we've now got a much better process for this. But we also had to contemplate how is this virus going to spread, what are some of the precautions that were necessary. And interfacility transfer was hugely important, courtesy of my friend and the committee vice chair, Dr. Brian Schwartz, and he is the director of the Land Ambulance Service in the Greater Toronto Area. And we were seeing transmission in the ambulances as well, so we developed a system to tightly control the movement of individuals throughout the hospital system that is actually in effect to this day. We called it the OSAC sweat shop. We commandeered the minister's boardroom, and they kept bringing us food. They fed us, and actually I gained an enormous amount of weight on being part of this that I had to shed. But it was a very difficult time. We worked from 7 in the morning till whenever at night and started again. What you don't see at the other end of the room was a big whiteboard of our priority list, which always seems to get longer and longer and longer. The ministry supplied administrative assistance. We actually had an individual who effectively worked as a court recorder, recording everything we said. You see the lady right there. And somewhere in the ministry is every word we've ever said about SARS. We had spent a great deal of time debating the right PPE. And that's a debate we don't have time to get into, but clearly the use of respirators versus masks or otherwise is still a hot topic today in the area of pandemic planning for influenza. After all of that rolled up, of course, we had the second wave of SARS, and that was really a difficult blow. We were exhausted. We were spent. We had to regroup. Unfortunately, we resolved that as well. What it did is it shook our confidence. In our hospitals, our staff did not feel safe. Nurses died. Physicians died of this disease. And, of course, many more patients and members of the community died. However, this was unprecedented in the healthcare system and really shook our confidence. The deputy minister at the time and the minister called for a public commission, a expert panel on SARS and infectious disease control is what it was called. I was privileged to sit on it, and the chair was my dean, Dr. David Walker, an emergency physician, so he understands emergency procedures. And we developed this report with a huge number of recommendations, as is typical for these reports, but they were heartfelt. It contained over 103 different recommendations that we wanted to see implemented. So after the SARS was over, this was our new mission. There's 103 things you have to do. The minister, the Honorable George Smitherman, the Minister of Health of the day at that time, we had elections soon after, Minister Smitherman really was very forceful in seeing that these recommendations were followed through, creating a very exciting time in Ontario. And I can't go through all 103 recommendations, but I'll go through a few and get a flavor of them, and we can compare how they to what you've done here in Australia. Certainly infection control staffing and training was very important, and it was essential to expand the availability of infection control training and to enhance this capacity by increasing the number of infection control practitioners. And the old benchmark of 1 per 250 beds, which we know is tired and old, but was what we started from. We've now moved to 1 in 100 as our goal, and they hired infection control practitioners for the hospitals. And so all hospitals, depending on what they already had, got boosted up. We developed what they wanted us to develop, a communicable disease committee, which we changed the name of to the Provincial Infectious Disease Advisory Committee. We know it as PIDAC, and I was privileged to co-chair it initially with David Williams, a medical officer. He is now the acting chief medical officer for Ontario, and I now chair it with Dr. Douglas Sider from the Niagara region, who's a medical officer. And having co-chairs is very useful. You can bounce ideas off each other, and that's extremely helpful when you've got me in the room. I need to be checked frequently. We have a variety of standing committees. We have four standing committees dealing with vaccines, infection prevention and control, communicable disease, and surveillance. And we have about 60-odd people who are drawn from the field and from government, but largely from the field, which gives PIDAC its real grounding in what people need and a voice to express what we really need in the field. And we develop guidelines and recommendations that go to the chief medical officer to whom we report, and the chief medical officer reviews these, some in a faster turnaround than the other, some of them are more complex, and they all go up on our website for public consumption. We've also developed something that we're really excited about, and these are called Regional Infection Control Networks, RICNs. We sometimes call them RICNs. The Provincial Infection Control Networks were developed along the 14 districts that Ontario is divided into, more on a population and geographical basis, and these coincide with regional authorities in the province, as it turns out, but they're not really connected to the regional authorities. They are a homegrown solution to what are bigger issues, and the regional infection control networks bring in all aspects of the healthcare system, including hospitals, pre-hospital care, laboratories, community services, and so on and so forth, meet locally with an office, have an infection control coordinator, an infection control educator or consultant, and a medical lead, and we develop local implementation strategies for the best evidence that's coming from PIDAC, and conduct surveys of our membership to understand what the needs are and to feed that back into the PIDAC, into the Ministry of Health. Another commission was sponsored in Ontario by the government called the SARS Commission. It was led by the late Justice Archie Campbell, who was a senior judge in Ontario, who developed a commission, and we had the opportunity to meet with him and a prolific writer, and developed a huge report. There's multiple volumes of all of the events of the SARS, and this is available on the SARS Commission website if you're interested. And the unfortunately and sadly, Mr. Archie Campbell passed away in 2007, but his reports stand as a very important reminder and judge and tell us what we needed to do in terms of what he called the precautionary principle in protecting the health of Ontarians as well as healthcare workers. The SARS Commission, I'll just quote one piece, the public health must invest in scientific professional capacity necessary both locally and provincially to provide meaningful expertise and advice to healthcare facilities and institutions. For long-term issues, protocols, policies, and directives, the province is a tremendous resource in the Provincial Infectious Disease Advisory Committee and its multidisciplinary approach and wide spectrum of expertise to play the role of advisor and expert. But no advisory committee can supply the operational resources to respond to immediate problems in the field that require speedy investigation and intervention. So he gave us an encouragement and a challenge that we needed to have resources. Minister Smitherman took the recommendations from the commission and came up with the Operation Health Protection, is how it was packaged, with 103 recommendations to be rolled out actually over 3 years. And we, some of them I've mentioned, there was the creation of the Health Protection and Promotion Agency, which I'm pleased to say in Ontario is now up and running, just in its infancy, as a CEO and senior management and a board. Public health renewal is very important. It's a distributed system with 37 health units and medical officers and communicable disease staff and public health employees needing renewal throughout that entire system. Health emergency management, infection control, and infectious disease capacity, health human resources, and an infrastructure for our own preparedness. One of the key issues was facility design, and this has been playing a role in hospital design issues that the provincial standards are being carefully looked at to build in safety in the emergency department, for example, rapid assessment centers with people with respiratory illnesses, the appropriate air handling, and so forth. We have now the Provincial Infectious Diseases Advisory Committee, PIDAC.ca, PIDAC.ca. We have some wonderful guidelines that are up on our website. One recently on resources, what do you need to run an infection control program? And I would recommend you to take a look. I'd be interested in your feedback as well and how it relates to your environment. The PIDAC committee has a number of subcommittees, as I mentioned, communicable disease, immunization, infection control, and surveillance. And we developed a number of what we call best practice manuals on cleaning, disinfection, Clostridium difficile, which was the first one we did, respiratory illness, and so forth. The organization is PIDAC reports to the Chief Medical Officer of Health. We have an executive committee, and we have the main PIDAC committee and four subcommittees, as I've mentioned. The Chief Medical Officer of Health was Dr. Sheila Bazar, and sadly, Sheila, partway through her term, and she was appointed after SARS as the Chief Medical Officer of Health for Ontario, passed away this June from a rare malignancy. And we were devastated to lose Sheila's guidance, and she was a wonderful, inspirational individual who was the Toronto Health Officer during SARS, who played such an important role in calming the public and was an outstanding communicator and leader. And we miss her deeply, and our agency's facilities being named the Bazar Center in her honor. The principles for the Infectious Advisory Committee are that we advise the chief MOH, so we know where the buck stops, that we try to be as evidence-based in all that we do. That's a real challenge. As you know, infection control, sometimes boils down to theology, because we have to compare one guideline to another and say what's going to work in our environment on best opinion. We don't necessarily always have the evidence that we need, and our research base in infection control is sometimes surprisingly thin. And if you want to start a riot anywhere, just ask, how is influenza really transmitted? And watch the room erupt. That is an answerable question. We work heavily using continuous quality improvement methodology, and jokingly we say that we take 2 days to solve all the world's problems, and we say that we're on candid camera only because we have video conferencing, so watch out what you do in front of the video conferencing unit. Our initial priorities, as I mentioned, were hospital design issues, advisory support to the emergency measures unit, a new emergency measures unit inside the Ministry of Health that Alison Stewart so ably leads, the strategic planning for our subcommittees, and, of course, getting it out on a website were our highest priorities. We reviewed the febrile respiratory infection documents, some of the directives that we had, and we've actually retired saying most of that we don't need. It was tailor-built to SARS, but screening for febrile respiratory illness in the emergency, in the admission process, and do you have a cough, do you have a fever, have you traveled? If there are yes to all of those, you got to stop and do something. Reviewed all of the SARS directives, keep them where we need them, review our high-risk respiratory procedures for the initial priorities. We then looked at the basic elements. That took a long time. That document was just released last month. And standards for reprocessing, which, as was mentioned by Chris, with respect to endoscopes and other things. And we have focused heavily on the antimicrobial organisms, resistant organisms such as MRSA and C. difficile for our own approach, as well as education in terms of core competencies I'll tell you a little bit about. So our surveillance priorities are the febrile respiratory illness. Surveillance for Clostridium difficile has now gone public in Ontario. We, as of the end of September, all hospitals report their Clostridium difficile rate on their website to the local health unit and to the Ministry of Health, where it goes on a website. That is going to be expanded. I'll tell you a little bit about that in the future. Vaccines, we assessed all of the vaccines that were available in Ontario. They're publicly available, and the human papilloma vaccine, for example, being one that we reviewed and recommended, among many others. And public health renewal, the public health system that keeps the community safe, had to have some changes as well. The Chief Medical Officer of Health, now in legislation, has a higher level of independence, and the bill was introduced in 2004 and has since been passed. There was a public health capacity review to look at the needs of what's required, and 180 full-time communicable disease physicians were added to the public health units throughout Ontario as part of this renewal. The Provincial Infectious Disease Advisory Committee is up and running, as I've mentioned, and we now also have the regional infection control networks that look at coordinating between those on the ground doing the work and those in the Provincial Infectious Disease Advisory Committee to look at what our priorities are and how do we get a lot of these things implemented in supporting hospitals, some of whom have very limited resources for infection control. There is a number of educational initiatives out of our university at Queen's University. We have a web-based infection control program for infection control practitioners that's going presently, and we've now had about 5 sessions, and we've trained over 200 ICPs out of that course. As well, our colleagues developed a core competency program for healthcare workers that you can access through the Ontario government website that is a flash-based system, interactive on hand hygiene, routine practices, which is what we call standard precautions in Canada, and we are wanting to get those implemented into the undergraduate curriculum for nurses and physicians. We've increased the number of infection control practitioners with targeted funding, and there's another round of funding, and we're moving to really 1 to 100 and specifying if there's critical care, burn units, and so forth, that you have to have a special allotment in that regard. The infrastructure for health systems preparedness we really have revolutionized. The goal is to modernize the processes for collecting and analyzing information on infectious diseases. The IFIS system is a Canadian public health reporting system that was implemented in all of the health units across Ontario, and they've been giving the tools they need to collect and disseminate the information. You've been using a similar model for hand hygiene. We have a provincial hand hygiene campaign in Ontario. We haven't gone with the 5 moments. We trimmed it back to 4. We felt that was a little easier to remember, and we can debate that. But we do have a justcleanyourhands.ca website. You're welcome to see our version of doing hand hygiene in Ontario style. And we have the four moments: when you enter the patient's location, when you do an aseptic procedure, when you after doing a dirty procedure, when you leave the patient's space. And we found that that was what would work well for people. We have our own logo. The Just Cleaning Your Hands campaign is being launched throughout Ontario hospitals. And this is one of the many posters that we have, with a lot of cleaning your hand posters and champion materials, and that are widespread throughout all of our hospitals. And again, this is the Just Cleaning Your Hands campaign. And the Ontario Health Plan for Influenza Pandemic is updated every year around August. So if you want to see our pandemic plan, you can just go to the Ontario government website or to PIDAC.ca, and it has all the links. And the pandemic plan is over 400 and something pages with all sorts of very useful pieces of information, again, drawn largely from those of us in practice that support that process, that give it a real grounding in the actual practice environment. The regional infection control networks had developed their own website, their own web portal. That is our logo, the cleaning hands pinwheel. We thought it was really quite attractive. Came from the Ottawa group who designed that. And each of the 14 infection control networks has their own sub-site for their own activities to communicate within the region. And you can see the geography of how it's distributed across the 14 regions in Ontario. Ours is number 10, southeastern Ontario, Kingston being right about there. Now, the crown jewel, in many ways, is the Ontario Agency for Health Protection and Promotion, which was enacted by special purpose legislation in Ontario and is in downtown Toronto. It has it's just forming up, has a CEO, Dr. Vivek Goel, and a senior management team is just being assembled. The agency is going to divide itself into a variety of areas, with clients being public health, healthcare providers, and government as its principal clients. Its functions are going to be surveillance, research, knowledge exchange, special laboratory diagnostics. The Ontario Public Health Laboratory is going to enter into the agency, professional development, communication, and a cross-cutting requirement is emergency management support across the province. So if there's big outbreaks, they will be playing a role. Their program areas will be infectious disease, health protection and chronic disease and injury prevention, environmental health, as well as the emergency management support role as well. So the agency is going to also be somewhat porous in a sense, will be drawing upon people from the field who can have relationships with the agency to allow them to participate and make this our agency, not just another head office somewhere. But so they will be probably a variety of relationships with people in the field to work with the agency. We have just launched reporting of health-acquired infections in Ontario. And this is the first is C. difficile as of the end of September, and I just grabbed what I could of the page. You can see some C. difficile rates that are expressed per 1,000 patient days. For some hospitals, this is fairly straightforward. For many, it was still a challenge. One month reporting doesn't inform you particularly, but it's trending that will be very important. And we will be, by the end of this year, reporting MRSA and VRE. We hope to also be reporting hand hygiene rates, as well as surgical, a particular group of surgical infections, ventilator pneumonia, and central venous catheter infections. Quite a suite of indicators that will be publicly reportable by the end of April in 2009. The Auditor General of Ontario has recently issued a report in the last month, Prevention and Control of Hospital-Acquired Infections in Ontario. It's a very interesting report. They actually audited three hospitals. That must have been a bit unnerving, having the Auditor General in your organization. But they published their report, and they do support what's been going on in Ontario, and so we're all on the same page, please. Many things have changed in Ontario and around the world. Some things haven't changed. The burden of nosocomial infections in Canada, and Chris showed one earlier for Australia, is still huge. We estimate at least a quarter of a million occurrences, infections in Canada, and that's probably an underestimate. The number of deaths is easily between 8 and 12,000 deaths, and if you factor in things like Clostridium difficile and the NAP1 strain, likely higher. What also has not changed is the impact that these have on our healthcare system. It's very difficult to get at the true cost, but we estimate there's at least $1.5 billion in there, if not more, in terms of the direct costs. And there's many indirect costs that are associated with a healthcare-acquired infection that are very difficult to capture. They're very, very expensive occurrences. And, of course, at a personal level, if you get pneumonia in hospital, there's up to a 30% reported mortality. You're likely to spend another 3 weeks in hospital. If you get a wound infection, the mortality is generally lower, but you're looking at least an extra week and maybe untold months of home IV antibiotics, nursing care, and suffering, and a cosmetically undesirable result. And the bloodstream infections, at least a 16% of direct attributable mortality and many weeks of extra stay in hospital. But the good things that have changed is that there is a very high level of global and national focus on infection control throughout the world. And in Ontario specifically, the provincial programs for infection control, such as our Provincial Infectious Disease Advisory Committee, Quebec mandating infection control practitioner numbers, because they had this huge outbreak of Clostridium difficile that was really devastating, with many other examples. What is changing is a recognition of where the expertise and to understand the role of professional associations such as ACA, such as CHICA Canada, as well as the role of academics and researchers and infection control practitioners throughout the system, who really now are finding in Ontario a venue with which to express themselves, to provide guidance and to be supportive and to make demands and to say these infections must stop. And when we hear the notion of zero tolerance, we're all aboard with that. We're looking towards coordination of efforts, strategic partnering between CHICA Canada, the Canadian Patient Safety Institute, the Canadian Council on Health Services Accreditation, that's changed its name to Accreditation Canada. I was recently going over some of their accreditation materials. At our hospital, it winds up for accreditation. Patient safety is very prevalent in those requirements, with required organizational practices to be doing surveillance for infections, to be looking at surgical wound infections, are now an accreditation requirement in Canada. You can't escape it. The Public Health Agency of Canada, I've had the opportunity to talk to you about, has done a major reorganization and is an important lead role in Canada in infection prevention and control as well. But we still need to have a great more research on hospital-acquired infections. The amount of research dollars that are spent on this, I think, is still poor. There are many fundamental questions about the epidemiology of Clostridium difficile, of how it is really spread. What is the best way to clean for it? We don't have an answer for, as an example. And so we do not see people going door to door giving money, collecting money for infection control. Be an interesting tactic, I suppose. I'm not sure if you'd get too much success or more doors slammed at you, but it's something to think about in terms of going forward to develop a research base for infection control understanding. So we do need to have more research, on, I believe, and this is an important gap that we have not yet addressed, at least in Canada, I don't believe really around the world. Infectious diseases as well, we have a multitude of agencies involved, and we have to behave in a coordinated fashion. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult to know the relationships, and that's still evolving in Canada as well, sort of an alphabet soup of organizations, and I'm sure that's true everywhere. So I do believe we need to work further to have more integrated surveillance. Canada is a vast country. Australia is a big country. The U.S. has big territories to cover with high populations. We need to get information from the practitioner to the region, to the province or the state, to the national, and even at a global level, and then in the reverse, so that we can all be aware of what is happening. Health practitioners are out of the loop if this is the point of infection prevention transmission, and feedback is a very powerful tool for all of us. In Canada, we have the Canadian Nosocomial Infectious Disease Surveillance Program established over 10 years ago, sponsored by the Public Health Agency of Canada, focused on nosocomial infections and brings together mostly the large teaching hospitals across the country. This is a program that has developed some very interesting research and understanding of infection control and its high potential, and we hope will grow in Canada to include many more hospitals. So I bring you greetings from CHICA Canada. We're 1,500 members strong, similar to the size of ACA, and our website, chica.org, is an excellent resource as well for you, and CHICA Canada is committed to improving the health of Canadians. We're becoming, like you, more politically active, more vocal about the need. We've now got the Power of One campaign, which is a research campaign for Clostridium difficile research that we launched at our last national meeting. Our next meeting of CHICA is in St. John's, Newfoundland, Labrador. I do recommend it to you. Newfoundland and Labrador is a wonderful part of Canada, and if you're able to make it, we'd be pleased to have you, and do let me know if you're coming. I want to thank ACA for the opportunity to speak with you today, and thank you very much.
Sadly, we're unable to open telephone lines for questions from the telephone audience. I believe, have we got a minute for questions?
Yes.
Okay. Has anyone got a question?
During your emergency declaration, does that mean you had basically be protected to legislative things to make people do things, or was it all carrot persuasion? In other words, does that actually mean you can fine people, remove them if they weren't compliant?
Yes, we did. Does carry. I'm not a legislative expert, but it, declaring a provincial emergency opens up a suite of authorities that the chief medical officer, indeed the minister, and the premier of Ontario have. It was a system-wide alert, so therefore really went to the head of government, who had authorities to commandeer hospitals and resources that were necessary. The Health Promotion and Protection Act in Ontario gives a medical officer of health the legal authority to incarcerate you, actually, something that most medical officers would never do, but they have a Section 22 of the Public Health and Promotion Act, which would allow them to specify an order that you need to curtail your behavior. For example, if you had a case of tuberculosis that wasn't complying, and they were doing that in the community setting during the SARS outbreak, when we really had a worry that this was going to spread in the community. So there was a lot of quarantining, voluntary or and by carrots that were being banged on people's heads, kind of like a stick to say, you know, and people who didn't stick with it, who violated that, and that did happen, were found out. It turned out I'm not aware of an instance when that resulted in transmission, but they certainly weren't very popular with their local health officer.
Dick, Leonard Harrington, Alfred Health. In terms of your move towards a 1-to-100 ratio, could you expand a little bit on the methodology that you're using to in that decision-making process?
Yes, the famous ratio 1-to-250, which goes back into the 80s, and now 1-to-100, I think are fraught with difficulties because it sets up an expectation that if you achieve the number, all the problems are going to go away. These are empirical. There was a process through APIC to look at this. I participated, and as a Canadian representative, to have a Delphi kind of process to come up with a number that felt right. There's the religion for you, I think. The process was based on that. We've had a similar process that went on in Canada. We took three groups of people, those from community practice, those from hospital practice, those from long-term care, put them in a room with a big whiteboard and said, duke it out, write down on that whiteboard what you think you need, what are the key functions you need for an infection control program. And so they wrote down the key functions, and then they tried to figure out how many hours does this take and what does that look like. And we published that, called the Infection Control Alliance paper, and I can provide you that reference. It was published in the Canadian Journal of Infection Control and then in the American Journal of Infection Control as a paper that went together. And we came up with a similar kind of number by people being isolated in three rooms for acute care and long-term care, a slightly lower number, but 1-to-200. I would love to see a more scientific approach where, for example, we could do time motion studies and analyses of all of the activities. I have found in my own hospital, we've moved from being proactive from surveillance to becoming an antibiotic-resistant organism, or ARO, unit. We spend an enormous amount of time chasing MRSA, VRE, Clostridium difficile, contact tracing, making sure all that works in a very busy hospital. So I don't know if we have the number right, 1-to-100. I think that's a double-edged sword. I think we need to build the programs around what the expectations, the outcomes should be, and then be effective in our use of resources. I think that's a better approach, but I don't think we're there.
Separations of patients instead of occupied bedrooms, so that itself doesn't give you the throughput within the health system when you're looking at practitioner numbers, because that really does tell you the number of patients that are coming through and the amount of surveillance that needs to be carried out.
Okay, I'm not sure I quite understand your question entirely, but
occupied beds.
Using the separations or discharges in
Oh, I see. Instead of the number of beds, I'm with you. Okay. I think you're onto something. Yes, the number of, you know, the human resources that are relevant to the volume of the work, so the number of patient days or the number of separations, the number of patients that come in or go out, would probably be a better way of evaluating it as per the beds. Because as we use the beds more efficiently, people don't come into hospital 3 days before their surgery anymore. They come in 3 hours before. So I think you're right. I think that's probably a more evidence-based approach. And I'd like to see that analyzed in a scientific way.